I'm Bob Boylan with a Plus One podcast from All Songs Considered. If you've never found a way to experience the joys and the tragedies of traditional British folk music, this could be your chance. The Queen of Hearts is the stunning new album by Afa Rex, and it's the project of English singer Olivia Cheney and the American band The Decemberists. It's a record Decemberist songwriter and singer Colin Molloy has always wanted to make. It honors the great British folk tradition, but it also rocks that tradition in the spirit of 60s and 70s bands like Fairport Convention and Steel Eye Span. On this edition of All Songs Considered, a transatlantic conversation with Olivia Cheney and Colin Molloy. It's a pairing that is inspirational and also playfully contentious. Seems like you've both found each other's musical mates in some ways. There's such a beautiful intertwining going on here, and
we've actually got nothing in common.
No, wait a minute. When you walked in the studio, I think the first words I heard were, "What were the original words to that song? Did she say maiden?"
Did you hear that? He's bitching about me singing the wrong lyrics to his favorite song, which the whole project came about over. He's still critiquing me.
Tell me more. What's the song and what are the words, Colin? What you getting wrong there?
Well, it was discussion. It's probably a discussion, an age-old discussion, as old as the hills. Yeah. You know, discussing what is the proper word, single word text in an ancient song. Willia Winsbury, which I know from Ann Briggs, Olivia came with this incredible arrangement, but I kept noticing that she was singing
imperfection.
Whether you be a maiden or none. So when the story, of course, is when the king calls his daughter to him and wants to check her out to make sure she's
virginal.
Still virginal and not pregnant, and says, and I had always heard it as whether you be a maiden anon, still a maiden, but Olivia kept saying whether you be a maiden or none, and it was a point of contention, but in the end I think snuck her version in.
But the thing is, with my accent, which has been obviously ridiculed throughout the whole project working with all these Portlanders, you know, I think it's still, it's open to interpretation which text I'm actually adhering to.
Yeah, I mean, in that sense, I think it speaks to the nature of the collaboration that we both tried to bully our way into it.
Let me play a little bit of the Ann Briggs for a minute.
The king has been a prisoner, and a prisoner long in Spain, and Willie of the Winsbury has lain long with his daughter at Ain. What ails she, what ails she, my daughter Janet? Well, you look so pale and wan. Oh, have you had any sore sickness, or yet been sleeping with a man?
Keep going.
Sorry.
Cast off your berry brown gown. You stand naked upon the stone. That I may ken ye by your shape, whether you be a maiden or none. And she.
That's it right there. It's gotta be a nun.
She sings or. Whether you be a maiden or.
A maiden anon, huh? Yeah. Let the listeners be the judge.
Yeah. One more time.
I think it's just you guys hearing it with an American.
I'm not hearing what Colin is hearing.
Yes. See? Bob's on my side.
I made a new friend and a new enemy. And
I'm out of here.
This is like
I'm
3 minutes in.
Well, Bob, I'm having a really interesting email correspondence with the great Andy Irvine, who I believe taught. And actually, did you say you think is he playing Bouzouki on?
I think so. So there's two Bouzoukis on that, and I think one of them is Andy from Sweeney's Men.
And I'm pretty sure he kind of would have taught this song to Anne as well. And anyway, I've met him a little bit, and I'm obviously a huge fan, and sing a few of kind of his other songs and arrangements. And I've been there's this I don't know what urban folk myth about the kind of origins of this song. And there was a myth going around that Andy had been in, I think, in the Vaughan Williams Library, Cecil Sharp House in London, and had been looking at the child ballad kind of text, and then had put the wrong, inverted commas, tune to the text. But I've asked him about this, and actually, apparently, it's a myth. So I should go back to him now and ask him about this pronunciation text issue as well, and see whether he can confirm that.
Well, I mean, the songs themselves are so fluid. I mean, they change. I think Anne may have got it wrong now. Now I'm going back.
How did you both come to this music? Is our mom and dad's to blame here, their record collections?
Certainly, on my side.
On your side, not so much on my side. I mean, I grew up, you know, a lot of Pete Seeger and John Baez, but I really came to this music, I feel, on my own.
Did you by accident, or did I just mishear? Did you say John Baez?
Joan Baez. Okay,
issue of the whole interview.
Her brother.
Are you a maiden or not, Colin?
Much better than Joan, John Baez. No, Pete Seeger and Joan Baez. Yeah. And sort of traditional American folk songs were kind of always swirling around. And then I kind of came to sort of traditional music. I feel like much later, and Bob, you and I have talked about this, but, you know, I think a couple of years into my life as a Decemberist, began discovering Fairport Convention and the sort of this side of the folk revival that I had not really been aware of, which is the part that was happening on the other side of the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. And that allowed, and to delve into this mystery that was, for the most part, I think, kind of a real fringy genre in America. And so it felt like a treasure hunt, digging up Nick Jones records and Ann Briggs records and things like that. And so to me, it was sort of this secret world that existed. But I don't think so much for Olivia.
Was that, well, for you, Colin, was that some of the attraction?
I mean, I think it was at a time when I felt I had exhausted, to some extent, like the music that I had loved and had felt the excitement of discovery going back to my teens.
You mean the Husker Du's and stuff of the world?
The Husker Du's replacements and Jesus and Mary, you know, Campervan and Beethoven, the kind of the subculture movement in the 80s in America and in England and pop, but searching out new branches of the British folk revival tree kind of brought back that feeling that I had when I was first discovering music in my early teens, you know. So that was what was really exciting to me.
And where were you, Anne, when you were listening to, you said your parents, mom or dad's in particular, but where were you living? And
he called you Anne.
I know, I love, I'm really, I'm honored. I'll take it.
Did I just
I'll be
do
Anne
that?
Briggs.
Oh my gosh. So, I was staring at this album cover of
Anne
Briggs.
I wish I looked like her, Bob. I wish I looked and sounded like Anne.
She was a wild one, too.
Yeah, totally.
So where were you, Olivia, in John Baez, Anne Chaney, whatever?
Well, probably all over. I mean, I grew up kind of mainly in Oxford, but I delved back to this repertoire after I'd kind of graduated from hothouse conservatoires. And
studying piano, studying voice, both?
Both, yeah, and kind of composition. And I got a bit, I felt a bit caged in and was just kind of experimenting and trying to push boundaries in my own head and music and within those places. And actually then weirdly found myself perhaps coming full circle back to kind of childhood listening, which was very much like my dad's record collection. So I had grown up with this stuff, but maybe, you know, as one often does with their parents or other people's elders' taste, you know, you maybe take it for granted. And I think in my whatever late teens and early 20s, I was like really like listening to kind of crazy variety of stuff. But I think I realized that in some sense, kind of roots, traditional, you know, whatever word you want to call it, music. The word folk is obviously so potentially contentious, but yeah, traditional music from all over the world seemed to be kind of at the root of a lot of what I was listening to. And so that made me like more deeply go back. And also just all those wonderful songwriters actually, and looking at what their inspiration was, you know, whether it was Dylan or Joni Mitchell. And actually, ironically, in that sense, for me, it was Fairport and Sunny Denny and Bert Jansch and all those people. But also, you know, my dad had very kind of transatlantic taste, I suppose.
Well, so, and that music was bouncing
exactly.
So back and forth.
And that's why this project kind of seemed really lovely, because it's kind of a transatlantic conversation in a way. And actually, I think I felt that Colin sometimes was like, no, we can't do that one because that is actually known as an American trad. And I'm like, yeah, but we brought it over there like a few hundred years ago. We, you know, the colonizers or whatever. But anyway.
I love that.
But yeah, my dad, definitely Anne Briggs was like absolutely one of his favorites. And like all men had a massive crush on her.
What was the music that when you first started to get together, is there anything on this record that might have been one of the early songs that you played together?
Yeah, one that got cut.
Dark Eyed Sailor?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think Willie Winsbury was maybe the instigator.
Yeah.
Still is, obviously.
And still is a point of contention.
Healthily.
So we were touring together. I'd heard Olivia's record and really loved it, and in particular, a lot of her arrangements of...
Which record, for those who don't know her?
It's called the...
Swimming in the Longest River.
Longest River.
The Longest River, actually.
From like 2010 swimming in
the,
or...
No, it's actually called The Longest River, but the title track is Swimming in the... So I can't even remember what my record's called. Sorry about that.
The Longest River. And aside from the fabulous songwriting, there is also some really great arrangements of old tunes, and particularly The False Bride, which I thought was beautiful. And we invited Olivia to come on a tour with us. And then I had this sort of secret fantasy that we would play Willie Winsbury with her at some point on the tour.
She chickened out.
And and we would just recreate the Anne Briggs version. And in that sense, it was sort of this selfish thing, I think, in retrospect, you know, that I would sort of try to live out the experience of having recorded Anne Briggs, you know, the Willie Winsbury. Mm-hmm. And she said no. Or we just never got around to it.
I was just a bit scared. I was like, but, really, jump on stage and do that with you guys after supporting?
But, and in the end, I think it led to a really... So then I had this idea, well, why don't we just make a record? Because now I want to see out my other fantasy of being in a 60s, you know, psych folk band from England. And I think Olivia was into it, but also, I think, helpfully poured a little cold water on some of it. No, I think it's true because... You know, from the outset, she was like, I don't want to recreate the Anne Briggs record. Like, what would we really be doing if we did Willie Winsbury, you know, slavishly to the Anne Briggs arrangement, which is true. I mean, we wouldn't have made a very interesting record had we just sort of aped the arrangements. And so I think between the two of us, me just hellbent on being in a legitimate 60s, as if I had a time machine, and Olivia being like, okay, let's cool our heels a little bit and like to try to make it our own a little bit.
Let me play a little bit of the, because no one's heard this yet. No, let me play a little bit of your version of Willie Winsbury, and then we can come and talk about what it is that you all brought to the table to make this not just Colin's fantasy. Right, Olivia?
I'm not sure if I want that role, but repressing Colin's unconscious.
Here we go.
Mm-hmm.
The king has been a prisoner and a prisoner long in Spain. And Willie of the Winsbury has lain long with his daughter at hame. What ails you, what ails you, my daughter Janet? Why you look so pale and wan? Oh, have you had any sore sickness, or yet been sleeping with a man? No, I have not had any sore sickness, nor yet been sleeping with a man. It is for you, my father dear, for biding so long in Spain.
So how did you approach this song?
I mean, the whole project for me has been, I'm so deeply grateful to Colin for obviously inviting me to come and work with them, but also for being really brilliant at kind of, in a sense, it's the wrong word to use, but kind of I feel almost commissioned to do some of these songs. Also, you know, to touch a song like The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face. But this as well, I'm a bit weird about, you know, if I love something enough, I feel like it's kind of untouchable. And I think I'm still to get over that as a musician. You know, I need to probably just be a bit, dare I say, maybe American and bolshy about things, and just like, yeah, I can do this.
I agree.
I feel like Colin kind of helped me with that. And because, like, literally this ballad, I know it may seem ridiculous, but I'd never really even dared sing Willie Winsbury in shows or anything, because it just, the Anne Briggs version is just so, you know, was so untouchable to me. So yeah, flying over to Portland and knowing I was, you know, suddenly going to go into Tucker Martin's lovely studio. And I actually, if I'm really honest, I came over with, you know, I'd done a lot of work on arrangements, but actually secretly with this one, I kind of came up with this once I'd landed.
Yeah.
And I'd borrowed, I can't remember whether it was Colin's guitar or a guitar. I didn't have an acoustic with me, and I was in an eccentric Airbnb situation, and was struggling with sleep and vocal issues and stuff. And I don't know, it just kind of came out. I knew it had to be something delicate. There was also obviously, you know, a whole thing of coming up with arrangements that would welcome everyone in the band and all the amazing characters and musicians in the band. And that was like really fun at times, and also with some songs really challenging. And so these guys were really, really cool, and Tucker also, in terms of like allowing the record to have kind of a shape and an arch here and there, where sometimes it was more pared down. And we captured this really, I don't know if you know, the whole record's to tape, which Colin and Tucker brilliantly decided, which was also a really fun thing for me to do, because I'd never done that and always wanted to. And this take, yeah, we just captured it live with Nate Query playing bass, and Colin kind of supported me on guitar. And yeah, it was just quite a magical live take, I think.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I do think that the there's a lot of instances where some of these songs felt untouchable to Olivia, you know, because of her connection to the folk scene and to the music itself. And in some ways, I think that we maybe gave her license.
Yeah, totally.
To, you know, because, you're not in a British band. You're in an American band now. And we can do whatever we want.
And I'm on the other side of the world. Because also, Bob, I haven't really, like, I know a lot of these guys. I mean, I don't know Anne personally. She's still alive, yeah, but very elusive. But I don't know her personally. But I know Andy Irvine, who, you know, taught her this song, and I know all the Carthys and the Watersons, and I know Shirley. And you know, I've just been playing shows with some of them. I just played a show with Neil McColl, Peggy Seeger, and Ewan McColl's son. And so it's like, I there were times with Colin and I where be like, yeah, let's do this or do this arrangement. I was like, no, but I can't because they might not like it. And, you know, I've got to go back home and face them all. What if they don't like the record? Like, literally for me, it was like a reality. And sometimes I felt like it's all right for Colin because he's just like in Portland on the other side of the world and he's got his.
It's funny because growing up around that time and I would buy records and you'd see like. The fun of it back then was seeing other people, all these same people you loved, doing all these similar songs. And,
right.
That was the playful part of it. And so I'm glad Colin's taken you out of the don't touch, you might break it.
But that's because I just played a show with Martin Carthy and his daughter Eliza and Norma Waterson. And there's other songs on the record which are, you know, very much inspired from them. And I asked him, this is kind of moving on to the song Queen of Hearts. And, and I said, Martin, I hope you don't mind. I've kind of done quite a, well, to me anyway, I feel like it's quite a radically different arrangement from perhaps like a trad folk setting. And he was like, you know, very laid back and just like, it doesn't belong to anyone, it's yours, you know, have it. But then I said, yeah, but what about Paul Simon taking your Scarborough Fair arrangement? And then he just kind of, I don't know, he looked a bit baffled and kind of the conversation didn't conclude, let's say. And interestingly, Andy Irvine, like, I think he is more, not territorial, but just like, yeah, you know, I did arrange, like I was asking him about another song that I've recorded with Kronos Quartet, Call You Rambling Boys of Pleasure. And I'm like, you know, do you feel you kind of wrote some of that song? And he's like, no, I didn't write it. I learned it from these guys. And he names all these old recordings and people he's learned songs from. But at the same time, he does admit that he does feel not ownership, but that, I mean, that's the strange thing with traditional music. There is so much creativity involved, actually. And so I think it kind of, yeah, I think that's where Colin and I have a really interesting relationship and ongoing conversation about a lot of this repertoire, because maybe he's just...
Well, I mean, I do think that a lot of those scenes, whether it be the British folk revival scene to the, you know, the indie scene in America, I mean, they can become kind of exclusive and a little bit, you know, sort of cliquish.
Precious.
And sometimes I think, you know, there's a place for an outsider's perspective. And... In so many ways, I feel like that was what we were often wrangling with, was trying to get Olivia to be an outsider us and looking in, you know,
but that
from
is
the
such
outside
an,
looking in.
Yeah, but that is, this is the irony, Bob, is that, of course, it's that thing of, you know, you find yourself always playing devil's advocate to things that you even kind of actually secretly agree with. And I think because I was on the other side of the ocean, because actually, so then I would seem like the insider. But of course, actually, when I'm doing shows alongside Shirley or Martin Carthy, I feel like an outsider. Huh. And I don't feel perhaps fully like they all are really lovely to me and they seem to love my music and what I do. But of course, in my head, I'm like, yeah, but I'm not trad enough. And I write my own songs and I do my own thing. So it's like, I just feel like a misfit everywhere, which I suppose is a total cliche. But
I'm going to play a little of Martin Carthy and then a little of your version of Queen of Hearts. Give people an idea. Here we go.
Young men are aplenty, but sweethearts few. If my love leave me, what shall I do? Had I the star in yonder a mountain, where gold and silver is had for counting.
And now, let me play a little of yours from the top here.
I could listen to that forever. Yeah. I just love it so much. It's so
That's
iconic.
Such a pleasure to see him in the early 70s.
Oh, wow.
With Dave Swarbrick.
Oh, amazing, Swarbrick.
Amazing. Here you go. I'm going to play your version here.
Thank you.
Can you describe you say, Olivia, that you had arrangements. Did you hand out paper? Were they actually?
I think the band would have liked it if I had. We spent a lot of time, like Nate, having to translate chords because Colin had done some crazy tuning on his 12-string, and then me shouting like, "No, A sharp," and then Nate going, "No." Like, yeah, so if you'd seen our process,
we just ended up playing all different chords a few times.
Yeah, we had quite a unique process, I think you would say. But yeah, this arrangement I had kind of tentatively. I feel like I'd brought this one over with me on the plane, but I felt shy of it, of course, being me. And John, the drummer, who's also kind of really deeply passionate about the repertoire, which kind of inspired this project, you could say, he has an amazing collection of instruments and had this electric harpsichord, this beautiful thing, which he brought to Collins where we were rehearsing it first. And I, you know, that was just right up my street. I'd just done a huge kind of quite creative commissioned project about Purcell, who's one of my favorite composers, and I grew up singing his music. And I'm, you know, friends with Trevor Pinnock, and like, so yeah, to have like a kind of 60s rocky electric take on Baroque harpsichord was just absolutely perfect, and also really perfect for this song, which was more serendipitous in a way because I hadn't planned all of that, but thinking about this song and reminding myself of the origins of it, not, you know, pre Martin Carthy, it's very much from that era. It's from Purcell's era, Restoration England. You can kind of hear that in the melody. So I think, I hope it's kind of quite fitting in
and
a way.
I think the arrangement and the production in particular, like, yanks it from Martin Carthy and kind of establishes it directly into the kind of 60s psych pop folk, which is was really what, you know, the target we were going for. I mean, all along, I was maintaining that we were kind of putting a bullseye on the wall that was made like a stack of Steel Eye Span and Fairport Conventions records, and we were going to shoot for it, but inevitably we were going to miss. But the arrow would land somewhere interesting, at least.
As someone who fell in love with that music and listened to that so much and was so part of my life, when I heard this, I wouldn't use the word miss, but it's different, but it feels so good. It feels so comfortable, like those records did.
Well, we really wanted to make it our own. That's what I say when I say miss, like, sort of an intentional missing. Okay. Like, we don't want to recreate or mimic overly. You know, we want to make it our own and yet have it be kind of a pan to that era of music making.
I knew a little of Fairport in the late 60s, but I went to a Jethro Tull concert in the very early 70s. It might have been their first tour, it might have been the second, I don't know. But there was a group that came on stage, and, you know, back then it was just hard to find stuff. And someone said, "Oh, yeah, that Steel Ice Band, they're really good." Mm-hmm. And I worked in a record store back then, and I had, you know, access to this monster, you know, 1,000-page catalog of, like, everything ever made.
Right.
And there was no group called Steel Ice Band, and I spent a good chunk of, like, 10 months trying to find out what this was.
Steel Ice Band.
Right.
Before the age of Google.
Before, yeah. And then one day, I'm in the back room, a order came in, and one copy of their first album on Chrysalis Records made it, and it said Steel Ice Band. I said, because it was like a banquet table or something, and it looked like old England, and I went, "Oh my God, there it is." And I was forever hooked on that music.
Except Below the Salt.
Yeah. Sure was. You got it from my terrible description of the album cover. We made reference earlier to a song that people know, and I'm going to play a little of it. It's a song performed by Roberta Flack called "The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face."
First time ever I saw your face, I thought the sun rose in your eyes.
It's I'm going to interrupt Roberta so that we can talk a little about the history of the song, because I think most people thought it was a beautiful, soulful ballad written, you know, maybe in D.C. or in Chicago or something. But
that's what I had thought always, too, knowing it from, you know, it's an Atlantic rhythm and blues record. And having, you know, it been in, you know, on radio and, you know, parents' records collection, I think at some point I discovered that it had, the song had been written by Ewan McCall. And I made a correlation between, wait, the guy who wrote First Time Ever I Saw Your Face also wrote Dirty Old Town? And there was this really, occasionally in this sort of wide world of modern music, there are these really strange lines drawn in from very disparate parts of the universe. And that happened to be one of them. So that led me to dig into, well, so where did that song come from? It was written for his then wife, Peggy Seeger, to sing, and
I don't think she was actually yet his wife when he wrote it.
It obviously
about
helped.
To be third wife, I think.
I mean, if you write a song like that, And so then discovering the Peggy Seeger tune version of it was so. I mean, the Roberta Flack one is unimpeachable. Is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. I mean, just listening to it right now in headphones, you just lose yourself to it. But then going back to kind of the source material, the Peggy Seeger version is equally unearthly. I can hear it coming in.
And the moon and stars were the gift you gave to the dark and empty skies, my love. To the dark skies, the first time ever I kissed your mouth, I felt the earth move in my hand, like the trembling heart of a captive bird that was there at my command.
Yeah, that could seal a marriage or a relationship.
Yeah.
Apparently, I'm not sure. I need to check this with her son, Neil, but and actually her, she's still totally going strong. But apparently she needed a song for a theater project, and he kind of wrote it for that. But then the romantic implications. Then they become, you know, husband and wife. So.
And you listen to that, and there's almost sort of a naive art approach to it, or sound. You know, it sounds almost like a field recording, like an old, which is more in keeping with what Ewan McCall, the sort of world he was working in.
And certainly all that stuff live to tape, like what you do with your record. That's
so my pitch to Olivia was, was you know, particularly on this side.
Keep going.
This side of the Atlantic, I mean, that song, of course, is owned by Roberta Flack. And I thought it would be interesting to go back to the Peggy Seeger version and try to sort of update.
But for me, again, although Colin maybe can't shake in perceiving me as like the kind of English folk girl, of course, for me, I'm like supposedly within the English folk scene, but totally grew up with the Roberta Flack version as well. And there goes the like cyclical transatlantic musical conversation, you know, and other culturally. So for me, I almost had to decide conceptually, one cannot shake off the Roberta Flack version.
Right.
And I think that's a really interesting kind of conversation in terms of what we've been talking about, of me being daunted to say, touch a Martin Carthy arrangement or an Anne Briggs, you know, the Queen of Hearts or Willie Winsbury. And this is like almost going backwards, because it's like everyone knows the version, which is actually, in a sense, a cover of the original, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like my interpretation, almost, it couldn't help, even if I tried to just be true to Peggy Seeger, I couldn't help but maybe have something of what I also grew up with, which was the Roberta Flack. And also it makes me think of, in this whole project and my approach to singing traditional songs, or actually singing covers of anything in a way, is what you do with melody. And I, even with the Queen of Hearts, just when you played them back now, I realized that I pull melody around a lot, maybe too much sometimes. But I think with this song, I really kind of tried to sit somewhere between them all and then say something with my own voice. So I hope I managed that. But I'm definitely indebted to Colin for pitching the idea to me.
I'm going to play this. I can't wait for folks to hear it.
The first time ever I saw your face, I thought the sun rose in your eyes, and the moon and stars were the gift you gave to the dark and empty skies, my love. To the dark and empty skies. First time ever I kissed your mouth, I felt the earth move in my hand, like the trembling heart of the captive bird that was there at my command. That was there at my command.
Who's playing the harmonium on that?
Oh, that's me.
That's just Olivia, and I'm still kind of, I just love listening to that.
God, I feel daunted hearing that back. Yeah, totally.
That was just Olivia in the room with her harmonium, and I swear that was maybe the third take.
Yeah.
I think we caught something early on. I think Tucker and I were both in the control room and listening, and it was the sort of thing that you needed. So she's just doing it all live, harmonium and voice in a room by herself, and the sort, it's like you only have I feel like when you're doing that kind of thing, you have a brief window. The window is just opening, and you're just learning and getting comfortable with it. And you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Olivia, because I just know this from experience doing this sort of thing. But then the window is open, and then the window so slowly starts closing again as you get farther along. So you really need to find that moment when it's really open. And even though you feel like you could do it better, you know, sometimes you find the one where it's right in the middle and there are some imperfections, but the sort of soul of it was there. I remember lying in the control room and just, like, I think I even maybe cried a little bit.
No!
I think I wept.
But this is, I wept after the Willie Winsbury take, so there you go. But
it's a lot of weeping.
Yeah, a lot of weeping. Intense project and academic arguing, too.
Sounds like a next album title, frankly.
But I would like to say, actually, in that sense, there's several takes on this record, Flash Company as well, where Flash Company, I came up with the arrangement in about kind of 5 minutes, and that basically we got to the end of the record and the time we had in the studio, and we realized that we didn't kind of quite have the shape we wanted, and it was like, we need another song. And I wanted to do something that was like really going back to a kind of field recording, but albeit field recording, a kind of iconic one by the gypsy singer Phoebe Smith. So I came up with that very quickly, and then we were kind of just jamming it. I tried to write something that everyone could join in on. I changed the time signature from what the field recording is very much like a waltzy thing in three, and I put it in four, and it kind of ended up like a country song unintentionally. But the point is that the whole band, but very much Tucker and Colin, were like, we've got it. That's the take. I mean, I seriously looked at everyone incredulously and was just like, you've got to be kidding. And that kind of summarizes like my, you know, me in the studio and them in the studio. And I'm really grateful. I learned so much. And I hope when I come to make like my next record, I will really, you know, deeply remember what Colin just talked about, because it's so true. And I really learned a lot from working with them all in that sense of about my own musicianship and about just being a human and a musician, of like, you can't, you know, that unattainable thing. And I think I'm always trying to get that. And I think these guys really taught me that sometimes the magic is there before you think it is.
We have like 4 minutes, so I want to do two things. One is, there were 3 dates in New York in April. How is this stuff going to be presented to the public besides this album? Are you all going to go out on tour? And how are you going to share this music live?
I mean, from the outset, this was a project that was centered around the arranging and recording. To my mind, it wasn't so much the live presentation of it, but we do want to do our due diligence and get it out there. And I think performing the songs live is exciting too. So we are going to be doing a very few amount of dates, mostly on the East Coast. We're doing Newport Folk Festival, and we're doing.
I will see you there.
A show at Town Hall in New York, and a show at a festival in Philadelphia. And then Off-A-Rex will also be playing one of the nights at our festival in Montana, Traveler's Rest, in August.
Oh, that's exciting. Let's get to the last tune. I hope we don't get cut off. Last song on the album is To Make You Stay. Tell me about this song. I don't know this song.
So this is a song, actually, one of the few original songs. Really, I mean, other than Bonnie.
Well, first time ever I see you.
First time I ever, one of the few. So it's written by Lyle Watterson, who was part of the Wattersons, you know, a seminal part of the British folk revival in the 50s even. I think it started in the 50s.
Yeah, late 50s, Norma Watterson's sister and brothers and, Hull, yeah.
And when I think Norma was in Jamaica or somewhere in the Caribbean on a radio DJ.
Yeah, as you do as an English folk singer.
Mike and Lyle Watterson made a record called Bright Phoebus, which, while I think maybe out of print or really hard to find, certainly digitally it's not available, it's a beautiful and incredible and experimental record. And it was them kind of breaking away from this wholesale, you know, doing only trad music, but actually working on their own material. And it's sort of the British folk revival's version of Sgt. Pepper's, I think, was how they were envisioning it. But To Make You Stay was a song on there. And then I actually learned our version from some demos that were actually released, some Lyle Watterson demos, I think by either Fledgling or Topic.
These are labels for those who don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, record labels. The lyrics are incredible. And I felt like it was a fitting. I don't think you can do a British folk revival homage without a nod to Lyle Watterson.
Well, I'll go out on that song. Tell me who's playing what instruments here. Do you recall?
So I think it's pretty much the full band, except for maybe Chris Funk is not on it. It's me playing acoustic guitar and singing, John Moen on drums, Nate Query on bass, and Olivia playing harmonium with the live track,
and then she did some
kind of piano, psychedelic piano tinkles.
Excellent. Tucker's amazing piano.
Well, I thank you for all this, and I'll see you in Newport. This is a beautiful, beautiful record.
Thank you so much, Bob. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. I hope people find their way to this who may not have ever, you know, that's how it all happens, and someone's going to own this record, and they're going to grow old, and they're going to pass it down to their...
We can
Next
only
generation.
Hope. We can only hope.
I do hope. See you in Newport.
Yeah, see you then, Bob. Thanks.
Cheers, all.
Thanks.
Be well. Olivia Chaney and Colin Molloy, the project with the Decemberists is called Off-A-Rex, named after an 8th century British king. The album, The Queen of Hearts, is out on Nonesuch on July 7th. 10 or so tour dates have been announced, including the Newport Folk Festival and the WXPN Exponential Festival in Philly. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.